Blog Talk Radio.
Watching you as you dream, the dreams I thought I knew. Your smile shows the reason I watched it all come true. Your touch is cold and distant, and I'm still loving you. I'm looking down.
Accompanist is Shout Even Shy, and it's a beautiful song, and someday it's going to win a Grammy Award, I'm sure of it. And starting out the show with that song always lifts my heart, and I would like to first of all say that we are a team of voices, and we are a poetry group. Under the umbrella of allpoetry.com, the largest poetry group in the world. And we have podcasts on Blog Talk Radio pretty much every night of the week, different topics, different hosts. And I am Lady A, and this is A Soft Place to Fall. And I'd like to thank our producer, Deborah Lee, who is the creator of all of the Blog Talk Radio shows. And she's the brains and the brawn behind all of these shows, and for that I'm very grateful. And so we are going, first of all, I'd like to introduce to you R.J. Hatter, the writer, the author of that song, and he's in the studio with us. Hey, Hatter, how are you?
A Grammy, huh? All
right, yeah. I'm waiting.
How does that happen anyway?
Well, you got to get it. You got to get it out there. I still say it's a winner. I love that song.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful song.
It's gotta be a soundtrack to some movie, huh? Soundtrack.
Yeah.
Movie.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, okay. You should send it to Robert Redford, Sundance. Yeah. Thanks for the word. I couldn't get it out. That would be he's really good at, I don't know if he has a music category, he must have something like that, but he's really good at, introducing new talent, unknown talent. So maybe that's the route you have to go and stick a name like his behind yours, and maybe that'll get it done. Cause I believe it should be done.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I need to check that out. I got more time right now. I should be doing that. Thank you.
You should be, because it's in the raw state that song's in right now. I think it's a winner, with just that acoustic guitar and her voice and your words and her music. It's just excellent. And I'll always say that about that.
I can hear a keyboard solo in there too.
Yeah. Oh yeah, I think it would be a really big hit. It's a really poignant piece of music and lyrics. So tonight I have picked a topic that hit my heart right in the middle of it last week. It's not going to be a happy topic, but it's I have to first say that I live in Canada. I'm from on the East Coast in the province of New Brunswick, and across on the other shore on the Pacific Coast is the province of British Columbia. And last week they unearthed a mass grave of over 200 children, children that attended the residential school out there, one of the many residential schools in North America, as a matter of fact. And these children were First Nations kids, and it's a horrible situation. And they unearthed the bodies, their bones, on the property of this residential school out there in Kamloops, British Columbia. And they're investigating all the other schools across the country to see if there's more of the same. So we're going to talk about the residential schools and how they came to be. And did you want to put a couple of 2 cents in there before I begin, Hatter?
Well, I haven't had time to really research it myself. I've learned to be very cautious of how things are reported before taking any kind of a opinion. But I will be doing that.
I'm going to give a little bit of background history of of our Indigenous people, and here it goes. Okay. So just the first people of Canada or these First Nations in our country, like your country, like America. It is actually Canada is the most multicultural country in the world, and home of immigrants of every ethnic and religious groups from every country in the world. But less than 500 years ago, which isn't really that long ago when you think of it, the only people living in Canada were the Aboriginal people of Canada. And Aboriginal means the original inhabitants, the people who were here first. The words native or indigenous are also used to describe the same thing, and they mean the same thing. And so you have within those groups of First Peoples or First Nations, there are many cultural groups within it. And there's actually 53 different languages, and each group referred to themselves by a specific name in their own language. For example, you have the Inuit people, colloquially, it's known, they were known as Eskimos for many years. That's what they were called, Eskimos, and have always referred to themselves as Inuit, and the meaning of that is the people. And a singular definition of that is a person, is an Inuk. And so they had all kinds of people that, you know, when, as time came, and Europeans came in, they had, you know, scientists and archaeologists that uncovered all kinds of artifacts and bones and that sort of thing. But they think that they have. Go ahead.
It's just a reminder of what the landscaping was back then. It was an ice age, so the glaciers came down to the Great Lakes, basically. So it being like an Eskimo, nomadic Eskimo would be, more correct.
Yeah.
Just to say that's not the wooded area we know it as.
No, and they talked about the how the globe was at that time, where the Asia was connected to the north, and how that broke away over time, and they migrated from the
land bridge.
Yeah,
there's
oral tradition within the First Nations themselves that speak otherwise, but. They even feel that some of them came over like in roving reed rafts, boats across the Pacific from Asia and various islands, and that were connected Europe to North America. But the Inuit who lived in the very high Arctic were probably the last ones to arrive, they figure. But the local oral traditions indicate very long occupancy in our country. And they thought that through their oral tradition that the ancestors have lived in North America for much longer than scientists indicate. And they're evolving new evidence and that sort of thing to prove it. And let me just see what else do I have here. But the cultural part of the First Nations is very rich, and they're still referred to in three categories by the government for administrative purposes. You have the Inuit, the First Nations, and the Métis. Excuse me. I'm just going to check the studio, and there's still just us birds in here. But so the Inuit, as I said, they were, you know, originally lived in the Arctic, and their original language is in Inuktuk, and they had several dialects within their group. And then the First Nations were called Indians by Christopher Columbus when he landed in North America because he thought he had reached India. And many now prefer to call themselves First Nations, though many still call themselves Indians in everyday conversation. And so... then I have to tell you, too, that they're still categorized by the Canadian government under the Indian Act as status Indians. And those who have lost their legal status are called non-status Indians. And Prime Minister Trudeau back in the 60s tried to get rid of the Indian Act, but the First Nations political groups insisted on keeping it because it defined their special status. And another part of... their heritage is the Métis, M-E-T-I-S, and they're a group of people who resulted from the mixing of European and Native men and women. And the Métis developed a unique culture because they were both had European ways and the Native ways. And a lot of it came about, too, because we were fur traders, and you had the Courier du Bois, which were, because Métis is a French name, and you had the Courier du Bois, who were the trappers, and they traded pelts and that sort of thing. And the Métis are still a very distinct group of people even today, and because of their cultures, the mixed cultures. So you have all of the, I'm giving you a little bit of history just so that you can understand that this is a very long and ongoing plight of our First Nations. You know, we have a language issue here in Canada, and between the French and the English, and the French are predominantly living in the province of Quebec, although there are small segments living elsewhere. My province has about 40% French. And they claim, Quebec claims that they are the first people to arrive, are the first people to live in Canada, and have totally ignored the fact that there were First Nations here well before any of us, our ancestors, showed up. So the charter, we have a, what we call the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, and it's Canada's first peoples were referred to as Indians, Inuit, and Métis in that charter, and they're recognized as special Aboriginal rights of those groups. So that's a little history of the beginning of our world as we know it. And I have to say that there's a lot has happened in between, because when you think about it, let me just put something else up here first before I say that. When you think about the way of life of the First Nations people compared to the Europeans that came over, they were hunters and gatherers, you know, and you have Europeans coming over with guns and booze and all kinds of things that they'd never ever seen in their lives, and so they're plucked out of their own way of life into a far more advanced way of life, which certainly took advantage of them in horrible ways. Did you want? I'm talking a lot, Hatter. So if you want to interject anything, feel free to go ahead and do that.
Yeah, I think you could date the migration of any one of those peoples that you mentioned by the glaciers retreating, getting smaller.
Yeah.
For the last several hundred years, if not even thousands of years. So, you know, that would be easily done as far as if you're a nomadic Eskimo, that you would stay on the ice. That's where you would be more comfortable. And the fur traders would slowly migrate north as the glacier and the ice melted. So
exactly.
Any events happen to be the clash between the two, those that were not nomadic. I don't know I haven't read what kind of the Inuit, and there was some Blackfeet also. Within the Indian tribe, the Blackfoot end up some of that.
You have all different types of tribes out there. I'm going to just give you a heads up on the different tribes of Canada. Just looking it up here. The different community. Like they really zone in on the Métis and the First Nations, but there's actually the different tribes within each province. And just a second, I'm just trying to do two things at once, and I'm not doing really well at it. All right.
They're the only ones that are considered Aboriginal, the Inuit and the Métis.
Well, they're all of the First Nations people are Aboriginal. The people that were here originally are Aboriginal people. I'm just trying to give you some the different, like there's all different names of the different tribes. There's all kinds of them. I'm trying to find something that I can pronounce, but because there's so many that you, like here in New Brunswick, you have the Mi'kmaq, and in Nova Scotia, you have Maliseet, and you have Ojibwe, which is mostly out west, and Let me just find some other ones here that are more familiar, because there's the Haida Indian also is out in British Columbia. There's so many. Looking at this list here, there's all kinds of, and this is just British Columbia alone. And so you have the Plains Indians, which are Blackfoot and the Ojibwe. You have and there's all kinds of other ones. You get Plateau Indians. You get the Western Indians, which are Chippewa and Cree, and amongst many other names here. You got Algonquin and Ojibwe again, Mississauga. And a lot of our country's cities and places are named, our First Nations names. So almost all of them around here are. And you have the Atlantic Coast here. You have Innu here, you have Maliseet, Mi'kmaq, Passamaquoddy, Haiden. Like, there's so many different tribes. And that's just in Canada. It's Seneca, you got
sure.
Mohawk, Oneida, Algonquin. There's, you know, and it's a very rich, rich heritage, because each one has their own culture and customs, which is really interesting too. And so when you think about when the Europeans did come over and they pretty much, they annihilated them out in Newfoundland. They killed off all of the First Nations people in the province of Newfoundland. And then, of course, we all know about the treaties, because that's, between your country's government and our country's government and the First Nations people, and you know how they did not keep those treaties for the most part. And so they had to, with First Nations coming up into their own, they demanded more respect and wanted to have, they introduced the Indian Act to help Canadians make reconciliation with the Indigenous peoples. And because, their land, they stole all the land and then placed them in these areas where you couldn't grow anything. They took the prime land and shoved them off into reservations, is what they were called. So I have a timeline here that talks about the different things that had taken place, if I may, going even back to Christopher Columbus in the 1400s.
Okay, let me pull up another map too. I'll pull up a.
Yeah.
Okay.
But I just want to, in the 1400s, you have the colonization of lands outside of Europe, which is what Europe did, France and England in particular, Spain too, where they sent people over to the Americas and claimed the land as their own. And then you had, that was in the 1400s, 1763, King George III gave limited recognition of title to indigenous communities at all, and the treaties on a nation-to-nation basis. In 1867, the British North American Act, now known as the Constitution of our country in 1867, a colonial responsibility for indigenous people and lands was transferred to the federal government. It's like a parcel. Here's a package for you. You can have, and then the Indian Act came into being in 1876, the consolidation of Indian policies. Then you had the Northwest Rebellion in 1885, or Métis and their allies led the five-month Northwest resistance against the federal government, in which is now Saskatchewan and Alberta. 1953, this is an ongoing, this is right up until today. In 1953, the federal government, I'm talking Canada, forcefully moved Inuit from Inuktitut to northern Quebec, to Ellesmere and Cornwallis Islands. So they just get out. We're moving you. And in the 60s, you had thousands of Indigenous babies and children were taken from their families and placed in boarding schools or foster homes in the middle-class Euro-Canadian families. That was in the 1960s. And then in 1982, the Constitutional Act, Aboriginal and Treaty Rights, entrenched in the supreme law of Canada, and that was by force of the Aboriginal people themselves standing up and fighting for themselves. And in 1996, you have the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People, inquiring to the effects of the residential schools. And then in 2008, that's not that long ago, a formal apology by our then Prime Minister Stephen Harper delivered a formal apology to the residential school survivors and their families. In 2015, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, the report with regard to those residential schools was published. And then you have in 2019, because this is another issue with First Nations, that missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, the National Inquiry, the report was published at that time. So, you know, it's been a long, long history of sadness, really, and of our Indigenous people and how they've been treated since the Europeans came over. I think what I'm going to do now, instead of talking so much, and then I want to talk about the residential schools after that. And I'm going to. I don't think Budo is calling in, so I'm going to put. Would you? Do you want to read it, or do you want me to read it, Hatter? Are you able to?
I if you need me to. Probably better off you reading it.
I'll put it in the room, and I can. I don't want to lose all my spots here, though, but I've got everything sorted out where I'm going to go. So I'm going to put it in the room. If this is for Budo.
Okay.
So you can take a look at it if you want. And
okay.
There, it's in the room there now.
Okay. Give me a second.
So I'll read it. Just I don't want to put you on the spot. It's hard reading cold, anyways. So this is from
okay.
Arbudo, and it's called The Forgotten. Brick and mortar seep wounds that can never heal in darkened halls, brandishing the cries and screams of 1,000 voices as one. In a centuries-old game of deceitfulness, disguised as the proper way via assimilation. Oh, how the First Nation bled from such atrocities brought to its knees in degrading circumstance and actions. Colonial rule was the arbiter of destruction, and innocence was buried to seal the truth of the unspeakable. May they rest in peace, and may justice reveal itself and render their fate to all, so that their memories can be revealed and their names be properly honored. Budo, this is a spectacular poem, and you have moved me so much, and you have honored these children and those that have, I hope we don't find in the future, the very near future, but you have given them their names through this piece, and I thank you so very much for writing for this this show tonight. Hatter, what do you think?
Yeah, it's written very well, and the more I'm researching about it, unspeakable. This is genocide. If
yep.
What the accusations are true, what this is written very well. To the point.
Without being
offensive.
Yeah, it's just a really great piece, and I think that I'm so happy that you wrote it. Thank you so much.
Hope they do find out from the grave what actually happened.
Yeah, I'm just going to tell you the story. I'm going to tell you the story of that right now, how they found the remains of 215 children found at a residential school site in near Kamloops, British Columbia. Okay, the causes and the timings of the death are unknown. It says unmarked graves containing the remains of 215 indigenous children have been discovered on the grounds of a former residential school in the interior of southern British Columbia. The grim discovery at a former school near the town of Kamloops was announced late on Thursday by the chief of the tribe, I can't pronounce it, Kamloops people, after the site was examined by a team using ground-penetrating radar. We had a knowing in our community that they were able to verify our knowledge, these missing children and undocumented deaths, said Roseanne Casimir, chief of the Kamloops group, in a statement. Some of the remains belong to children as young as 3 years old, but the causes and timing of their deaths are not yet known. At this time, we have more questions than answers. And so that particular school was established in 1890 under the leadership of the Roman Catholic Church. And it closed not until 1978. And it was part of a cross-Canada network of residential schools created to forcibly assimilate Indigenous children by removing them from their homes and communities, forbidding them from speaking their native languages or performing cultural practices. Physical, emotional, and sexual abuse were rampant within these institutions, as was forced labor. At least 150,000 children attended such schools in 2015 Truth and Reconciliation Commission described as a cultural genocide targeting Canada's Indigenous people. In documents submitted to the commission from former Kamloops attendees, described the harsh conditions of the school. And before I go any further, for the listeners, you might want to, if you have little ones, I wouldn't recommend them hearing this. But it's not a pleasant discussion. It's not pleasant what took place. So listener discretion.
We can supply the links when they want to research any of the graphics stuff.
But I just want to. I have all the links too. But I just want to say that these schools were a hotbed for abuse, and some of the things that the schools were cold in the winter. They were dirty. The kids were hungry, and this, all I'm saying too, are there were many survivors of these schools, and they have been the speakers of those ghosts that are in the ground. And so there were all kinds of astute kids that were exposed to outbreaks of measles and tuberculosis, influenza, any other contagious diseases, and many died. So they talk about that a little bit, about these.
Yeah, it sounds to me like Canada made the Aboriginal children wards of the state or the government, and then failed them and couldn't fund or want to have that responsibility or that economic.
Well, the thing what they wanted to do is they wanted to beat the culture out of them. I mean, they were punished for speaking their own language. They had their hair cut off.
That's what I'm saying. They became wards of the state, of the government, and then maybe the government didn't want that responsibility anymore, and they decided this genocide thing was going to be just it's another story of Hitler and the Jews. I mean, that's one aspect of what possibly had happened. Until they investigate when these children died, how they died, and that's that sounds like a big problem. I think Australia just went through a cultural Aboriginal decade or an era. I think Canada's ready to go through theirs.
Well, Yeah. But, I mean, you know, you guys had the same in the U.S., too. Like, they were in North America. Like, they were right across both of our countries. And so it's not just Canada. It's, like you say, it's any place that had Aboriginal people suffered similar tragedy. But this was a systematic method of taking their – they would go into these communities and virtually take the children from their parents' arms. The parents had no say.
It's cultural genocide.
Yeah.
Eliminating a culture out of their history. Yeah, it's eliminated.
Absolutely.
It goes on all the time, and it's at some level everywhere. You try to get rid of, you want to get rid of a certain religion, church or anything.
Yeah.
Like you go through these processes before it happens, and it could take a long time. But it always picks. And behind it is a kind of a underground government thing that has that want. It's usually a hatred or misunderstanding. I don't know.
Yeah, because my question is why? Why would they, you know, why did they want to force a group of people to be like they are? Or like they think they want, they should be, the judgment that came over their way of life, the judgment that came over their language and their culture
were fanatical. They're zealous of it. That's a reason of why it happened. But to take and want to erase a culture and completely eliminate it. That's genocidal. That's beyond. That's a hatred.
Yeah. Yeah, the prejudice and hatred, and it still goes on. And there's so much to be said for this topic. It really shakes me to my core because, there's a lot of prejudice in the world, and we don't even hear hardly anything about the prejudice that goes towards the First Nations people of our countries. And
this just proves every country's got their own, got their dark skeleton in their closets, and history was written a different way than we were taught, and we're all learning that now. We can't be thin-skinned,
yeah.
That it tears down social bridges. You just got to be careful about that. Don't antagonize the situation, because it's like Martin Luther King. He wanted a peaceful transition for equal rights. He did not want riots and violence and Tifa and
that
kind of crap. He did not. He wasn't speaking like that. And that's the way we've got to approach this as civilized people. It's like anything else. I mean, the Canadian people are going to have their day in court, the Aborigines, and you're going to go through what everybody else has gone through, you know, cultural awareness, culture appreciation, and maybe it's about time. You never know.
It just baffles my mind, though, when you think about how these kids were ripped from their families and shoved in these places.
Sure.
And without,
that's
you
like
know,
the orphanages,
without the love of families around them and all the horrible things that took place and the things that happened to them. And, you know, and at the hands of people who claimed God as their leader. And we won't even go there, but I don't want to get
too crazy. Just because it was the property, that's like saying the Spahn Ranch owner of Spahn Ranch was responsible for the Tate LaBianca murders. That's not true either. Just because it was a building that Roman Catholics used does not mean that genocidal was the how they acted. I wouldn't believe that, not until there was any kind of proof. The state can come in and do anything they want on any property.
What are you saying? That
the Spahn Ranch was Charles Manson. That's where the family was, Charles Manson. And the owner of Spahn Ranch is not responsible for what happened on Spahn Ranch or what came out of Spahn Ranch. So I don't think you could point a finger at the Catholic Church just because the building at one time or another had it was a church.
Well, you know what, Hatter? I have to totally disagree with you there, but we're not going to get into that tonight, if you don't mind, because history.
I don't mind. We shouldn't.
The history
we
with
should,
these
be.
Places
we be
was they were
about,
run
we were
by
really,
by priests, and they were run.
It didn't need to be mentioned then. It didn't need to be mentioned then.
I didn't need to mention it.
No, not if you can't. If you can't, if I can't say that. Listen, until further investigation, you can't blame the owner of a building because of something that happened there. Otherwise,
the owner
you
of
are
the build-
pointing your finger.
No, the owner of the owner of the building and everybody that worked in the building was a part of the same group of people. So, I mean, I don't know what you want me to say about that, but. That's common knowledge who ran those places and who taught those so-called teachers that were within those buildings.
Okay.
You know, so I hear what you're saying, but I mean, you know, it came from somewhere. But in any case, the point tonight is that these children were stolen from their parents. The parents were powerless. They had no say. They couldn't fight back. They couldn't fight the government. They just took them. They just walked into their homes and took these kids, thousands of them. And like you said, it was like a planned genocide to beat the tar and the culture out of these kids. It has only been these last, I'm going to say, 15 or 20 years where some of these places or these reservations where the First Nations people live, that they've been taking back their culture and their language and their customs. And they've become, a lot of these reservations have become dry reserves where they don't allow alcohol or drugs. And they celebrate this, their culture. And they have progressed and healed themselves. And so that's what I pray for every other reservation in North America, that they do the same, that they can recognize their worth and celebrate who they are and the cultures that they come from, and our government tried to beat that out of them, and which is, you know, horribly sad. So I'm going to, I just checked this, there's nobody else calling in. So whoever's, I don't know who's on the, I don't even think there's anybody out there on the board, really, to be honest. Let me, you know, see. Yeah, no, I don't think there's anybody in the, on the board watching. But in any case, I have, did you bring a poem, Hatter?
No, not about this subject, no.
So I hope Deborah's going to call in. She's got a poem, and I have a SoundCloud for Titus Llewellyn. So I'm going to put his in the room first, and then we'll play the SoundCloud. How does that sound?
Yeah, it's fine.
I'll put that in the room, and then I'll press the button. There. So it's in the room there now, Hatter. And here we go. I'm going to turn it.
Get that.
There.
Okay, I see it.
Earth angel, Malak. Malak, it means angel, as she will learn in time. It was when she stumbled into our hearts. Miraculously, she smiled, showing bravery to escape from this cataclysm. Atrocious goings on about her, they witnessed devastation. As Adana longs to end the silent traumas these children are going through, small, and yet we rely on individuals whose only voice is heard and the alibi keeping Malik's hopes alive and well. We value her at this heart of oak. So close to home, it means to keep her safe and well. One's future tells the story of a father whose love cannot be told. His love will convert, unduly marred by all of this. And yes, the saddest days she's gone through may have found trusting someone other than a parent's help for whom. By choice was not the case. The fear of any backlash she would absorb lift her to a place where love comes first. Make that gift a life festival. Extract what little good there is and save a peace, tranquility for sure. Dust yourself down, pick yourself up and smile as you do, angelic kind. Illuminate the good that has been given. Welcome to the world of Sadi. Not to confuse or misuse, that wise discretion will in time be awoken. The little girl who has nothing but kindness in her heart will still inherit, oversee the future of those who are left uncertain. She'll just say shalom, offering such sympathy that will make others strong you cannot undo. Undying love as well will be found. That is your paradise awaits in situ. Recognize the good in others who haven't found, and yet it will appear. Help is at hand, and even if the physical help you've had is not enough, economy of sorts, that patience evolves to have us listen, given space and time to think things over. You'll smile as you did before the trauma. Remarkably, you are safe, and your faith, a simple kindness, will linger. The temple you reside in has nurtured a sincere depth from the heart. Survival is at best a miracle. As angels, we understand the pain of others.
Wow. That was pretty powerful, Titus. I see that you wrote this a couple of years ago, but it certainly can be applied to the children of today and the children of this community. And I think that keeping Malik's hopes alive and well, we value her as the heart of oak. And I long to be able to say that we value children in this way, and they are our weakest of society, our young. And there were some quotes say that you can tell what kind of a society there is as to the way they treat their children. Some say they're animals, how they treat their animals, but how they treat children. I think that to be able to look into the eyes of a young child and see the future and to see that there is love and hope, and sometimes it certainly isn't in this life, it is in the afterlife. That they will be able to feel all of those wonderful good things, the warmth of love and the safety and security of love. And I thought this was a beautiful poem, and I think that you did a wonderful job writing it and speaking to the plight of children in the world, actually. And Hatter, what did you think?
Yeah, it's very deep, very well thought out. The help is at hand, even if it's the physical help. And time to think things over, you'll smile as you did before the trauma. Remarkably, you're safe. It's all wrapped up in the last line. Survival is at best a miracle. As angels, we understand the pain of others. you know, it sort of gives the outlook of somebody watched it happen, and that's going to be the norm, I'm sure. And it's the actions of others that determine history.
Well, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'd have to read this a couple of times to get the total. But,
It was a great, write for sure. And you know, your speaking voice to Titus is, lends such wealth to all of your poetry. I quite love it. And I thank you for sharing that with us tonight, and for contributing to the show. I very much appreciate it. And So I'm going to just kind of carry on with, you know, we can talk about a lot of different things with regard to this. I know that on my cover page I submitted some pictures, Hatter. I don't know if you saw them or not, but you can see this one picture was quite moving as a young boy in his native dress. His long braids, and he's transformed to be a Canadian, and which I thought was really difficult to see, because his culture was taken from him. So I'm gonna take this opportunity to read a poem that I wrote a while back, and because I wanted to talk about you know, the importance of part of their culture, especially with the men in particular, where you know they have their hair is long and braided for the most part. And I'm going to read you did a little bit of history on it, but talked about the importance of the braids for the men, and so I put this in the room there now, Hatter. So this is called His Braids. Once proud, strong, decisive, rode bareback on their ponies into wars with other nations, protected land, women, and children. Faces painted, braids plaited, armed with bow and arrow. Echoes heard, the white man wanted all the good land. They rode their painted ponies into battles with white phonies. Arrows had no power over guns and gunpowder. Duped by beads and mirrors, liquor, lies, and promises. Signed treaties with the white man to steal the ground they walked on. Proud braves then cut their braids, forced to conform to white man's ways. They lost power, pride, and culture. They lost hope for any future. Just as Samson cut his hair, he became weak and filled with despair. First Nations fell to their knees. No one heard their pleas. Today their braids have grown, now empowered by spirit blood. The ancients whisper strength, blow pride into their lungs. Long black hair and braids, Indian boy dances to the drums. Braids, power, strength, courage of the ancients, watching with assurance. And poem. What do you think of them, Alice Hatter?
I'm trying to hold on one second. Okay. Well, for what they Delilah cut Samson's hair, right?
Yep.
Okay. I totally agree with the power of. There's a theory of why we have hair. If we, why did we not lose all our hair? If the argument says that was evolution. There's a lot to be said about at one time they were we were able to sense things we cannot sense now. And that one thing would be presence of another living thing, to be able to know something's there without hearing, touching, seeing, or hearing it. But you know it's there. A lot of the indigenous tribes connected with this, and I think it speaks of that to a point there. They cut Samson's hair. So I do believe there is, in the culture, long hair has a more significance than just a fashion show, a fashion statement.
Mm-hmm.
I do.
I'm looking that up too. Let's see what it says here. Yeah. It says here that the long braid for First Nations male symbolizes many things: strength, wisdom, identity, and culture. Most important, it honors the ancestors. I like that. Let me see, what else does it say from... See, I find these kinds of things, when you do a little bit of research on them and you see the significance of different things that you might take for granted, I think it's really a wonderful thing when you see what it really means from the people themselves.
There's a story about long hair and the Native Indians, the Navajo Indians, for one, in the U.S. Army. What the Army ended up doing was, besides not knowing the characters involved, it went something like this: a sergeant or lieutenant in the field had his own squad troops, and he was asked how come his scout, who was a Native Indian, did not have to cut his hair. How come his hair was long and the rest of it all cut? And he says because without it he wouldn't be my scout. And then some general or somebody high up questioned that, and so they did an experiment where they took Navajo Indians, cut their hair, left them as a scout, and they left some Indians with long hair. And test after test proved that the Indians with the long hair had what they called presence. They could feel another, the enemy, without hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, seeing them. The other group that they cut their hair was just like any other scout in the troop. So they did this test, and from then on it was adopted sort of an unwritten rule. And I don't know, since the Korean War, or I think this was done around the Vietnam War. And you can look it up if you just use those kind of questions. Just say it was written by this author's wife, who witnessed her husband go through these research of the Native Indians and what hair meant to us as humans too, whether we lost the sense. Many of them said that without the hair they feel weaker, a sense of knowledge. You can see, you can sense other people's aura or in their attitude. You can sense where they're coming from. You're in touch with the metaphysical more with long hair. When you cut it, you don't, because it is antenna. It is the closest thing. It is the closest thing to the brain, if you think about it.
Yeah. Hang on a second.
So
I'm going to let somebody
look at it. It's very fascinating. Yeah.
Yes.
Hello there.
Hi. Welcome to South Place to Fall. Who's calling, please?
Oh, don't you recognize my voice there, Lady A?
Yeah.
Oh, just now I do. Yeah, but I just remembered that your area code. I just recognized it too.
Oh no,
welcome aboard.
Problem. No problem. Man. I wish I had some time. I thought I'd stop by for a bit. I know that I wanted to see was just to spend some time with both of you. A little bit of time,
okay.
Of course. But I thought
We've
I'd come
over
and give you some support.
A lot of discussion. I don't know if you've heard any of the show or not.
No,
I can't
not,
give you.
Unfortunately,
and give you a quick review because it would be too much. But I just wanted, we were talking about the significance of long hair in the First Nations people and their braids. And I just want to read something by an author. Her name is Sister Sky. And a lot of times, it said at powwows in particular that it was common to see family members and friends brushing and braiding the hair of each other. And it was a bonding part of their relationships, and it reinforced the sacredness of their relationships by, you know, grooming each other. And the symbolism of the braid itself, it reaffirms the practice, and it said that a single strand of hair, that single strands of hair are weak when tugged on. However, when you pull all of the hair together in a braid, the hair is strong. This reinforces the value of the family and the tribe, along with the connection of all creation. Here's a story I'm going to tell you here, that this woman was, the Sister Sky, saying, she said, when I was 5 years old, my grandfather first told me about being forced to cut his hair when he was carted off to boarding school. And I'm sure I heard this more than a dozen times as I grew up. But as I got older, he would tell me more about his experience and what it meant to him. And eventually, he told me his hair was cut in an effort to strip him of his culture and identity. Cutting his hair was the way of showing dominance over him, forced assimilation. He said that every time his hair was cut, he would cry. And every time he would cry, he would be physically punished. Unfortunately, being forced to cut one's hair was a common practice in many of the institutions and schools across the country, and it's still occurring as recent as 2018. And so they're taught, his story was important because we were taught as children that we don't cut our hair unless we have experienced this significant loss, like a death of a close family member, a traumatic event, or a significant change in life. And the tribes have different teachings about the value of hair and how to care for it. And so it was a very, very important part of their lives and their culture and their dreams. It's when we cut our hair, it represents the end of something that once was and a new beginning. When we do have to cut our hair, it is never to throw it away, but rather burned with sage or sweetgrass in a ceremonial way. When the hair is burned, all of our thoughts, prayers, dreams, aspirations, experiences, and histories rise to the Creator to be properly taken care of. We are then guided in the direction for our prayers to be answered. Throwing our hair away is a form of personal disrespect. So when my grandfather had his hair cut off and thrown away, his tears were of deep grief and confusion, helplessness and shame. It was against everything he had been taught, along with grieving the loss of everything his hair represented to him. When this culture practice was common in most Native communities, it was easy to recognize when someone in the community was grieving or experiencing significant change in their life because their long hair was no longer. Something as simple as that had tremendous meaning, you know, and it had profound effect. And you think of all these children, 150,000 children that went to these schools and boarding schools, and the first thing they did was cut their hair. And it just the significance is just amazing to me, and horribly sad. I know I'm running on, Frank, but I don't know if you had a chance to review or look up anything with regard to tonight's program, or if you'd like to make a comment in any way.
You mean on what you're talking about?
Yeah,
what
like
do you mean
the,
by
the,
next
the
program?
Pardon me?
I'm not sure what you mean by next program.
No, no, like the, what we're talking about tonight, we're talking about the First Nations people and the...
Yes, that's what I understood.
Well, you know what, Lady A, back in those days, colonialism, what they would do is they'd go in, they fought the customs of the native people that were behind what would be considered third world back then or whatever, to be, for lack of a better word, they were trying to help them lose the old ways and accept the new, if, for lack of better terms. They thought it was they were savages, and many times some of their actions were. The traditions were seen as barbaric to some of the new colonials, where they wanted to school them, teach them their language, teach them about their religion. I don't think it was done in such a malice way that it's being portrayed today. I think they were trying to do the society good by bringing them up to society because they would be left behind. Now, how they were treated in the process, I don't agree with. I'm sure they were absolutely horror stories. But you got to put yourself in those times, how they colonized the different areas of the world. It's very complicated. Some of them were savages. Some of them, I'm sure, weren't. But the process
of
the
pattern.
What?
No, I was going to say, you realize one thing, that we're basing this on the criteria of our own point of view, in the sense of, you know, the Native American, I mean, it's not, for example, I will give you an example here. The Spanish history itself has a whole conglomeration of invaders and so-called invasions. And there isn't really the purity of a Spaniard there. You know, you can go to Europe and you don't really find a purity of this and that. You find a whole mixture of different ethnicities of origins there. And if before the Romans came, the typical Iberians, you know, the Romans would consider them equally barbarians as well. But of course, the Iberians, they consider themselves Iberians. They would consider themselves the culture their own. So the Native Americans, if I can say, you know, perhaps to many were seen perhaps as savages, but typically Europeans. But they had their own, and if you've asked, and I'm certain if you ask a Native American now, he would say, well, it was typical. This was my lifestyle. This is what I knew. And to me, this is the lifestyle that my ancestors lived, and this is the lifestyle that represents our culture. So it's like a slippery slope there, Hatter. We don't know at times, you know, it's like we think we are educating someone, but in the end, we're only educating them what we want them to be educated on. But most of the time, they have their own, you know, their own wisdom. They have their own stories, their own lore, their own traditions. Perhaps we don't understand them to the full extent, but if you do ask them, they would say to you...
The mindset of the people colonizing them, the mercenaries or whatever they were called back then, they didn't look at it to save a culture at all. It wasn't even probably thought of.
Yeah, we're getting too ridiculous.
So the evil darkness of trying to strip somebody of their culture, I don't think was considered. I don't think that was a driving force. I think it was to educate the people to a point. I'm sure the dark side of humans always, everything we touch, we screw up. But, you got to look at it, the people, the mercenaries, who am I trying to think of? The people that go in to teach the...
Missionaries.
No, they are
missionaries.
I have to interrupt for a second here, because I know what you're trying to say, but I cannot agree with it personally at all, because...
I'm not defending it. I'm not defending it at all. I just want to know make sure that everybody's thinking, realizing the time period you're talking. There was only one mindset. I'd have to agree,
but these schools were in effect right up until 1978. So, you know, you're talking back in the 1890s. Yes.
Yeah, I'm actually talking a little further back than that, but.
But their purpose was that they thought they were doing them to bring them back into, bring them into the present and the future. Yes. But what happened was, you know, there maybe the initial intention was good, but when you think about 150,000 children in Canada stolen from their families and systematically broken. You know, this is what I'm talking about.
Sure.
This is the topic.
Absolutely.
And
that's evil. And anything in modern day, any action like that modern day, it could be considered totally different than that. That's a cultural genocide. That's nothing but, and that's evil and bad. But when I was talking generally before that, the first people that introduced to the Indians, cut your hair, change your clothes, here's the ABCs. I'm talking the first contact, the cultural change, the want to change them, and the problems. I'm not talking about the modern day evil
of
the
state.
I understand that.
That is, you know, what the topic is tonight. It is that modern day happening.
Well, you had to. I thought we were talking about how we got there.
Well, I mean,
talk about how we got
there. If you look
at it, so I thought we'd start beginning.
If you look at it, without straying too much into the realm of the subject there. I mean, it would be interesting to have the observation of a Native American, whether it's in Canada, Central America, you know, because the whole thing of Native Americans, it's a misconception for me, because Native people are all over America, it's not just in the United States and Canada. They're in Mexico, Central America, South America.
Every country had their
It's a whole notion of the Americas, and people think the Native Americans are strictly only Canadians America.
Tribe in Southern Spain.
Yeah, you have to really go and talk to, really, I've spoken to several of these people, and you get really the perception there, that, you know, you get the feeling of understanding their plight. They might not know the whole history completely of 100 years from now. They can relate to what's going on in their society now, you know, and that's the thing that I find refreshing. When you go with other people and you hear their cultures, you listen to them, you get their point of view, then you start understanding a bit more of the outside world there. In all my years of traveling, I've come across different peoples of diversity, and I've come across to learn and understand, or at least try to appreciate, all of these people from diverse places of the world who have their own stories. Just like me, you, and Lady A, we have our own stories. And to them, you know, if I take you out, and I take you, Lady A, I take you around the world with me, and people meet you, then they will get a sense of who you are and who the both of you are through what you tell them. And that's how lore starts, and that's how tradition starts, Hatter.
What started the conversation, Frank, was they found a mass grave in Canada that was filled with 215 Aboriginal children.
From the theme, I read some information about this. That's very it's very haunting there. I mean, it's
So we digressed a little bit, but let me just get us back on track a tiny bit, and then Frank, I'm going to put your poem after I do this. So we were talking too about, and Hatter was brought it up, about the genocide. And Indigenous peoples in Canada. So the genocide, just to give a definition to it for the listening audience as well, it's an intentional destruction of a particular group through killing, serious physical or mental harm, preventing births, and or forcibly transferring children to another group. The term has been applied to the experiences of Indigenous people in Canada. I'm talking about Canada because this incident happened in Canada. I know that it's more than just our country, but...
Can I ask what part of Canada, what part of a province? Can I ask the province that it happened in?
These children's bones in British Columbia on the West Coast.
Okay. Yes, I know what that's at.
So... It can be applied to the experience of Indigenous people in Canada, particularly in the final reports of what is called in Canada the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is referring to the residential schools, and the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Children and Girls Inquiry that's going on in Canada as well. So the definition of a genocide, a Polish jurist, Raphael Lemkin, coined the term genocide in 1944, and it combines the Greek genos, meaning the race or tribe, with the last Latin side, meaning killing. So genocide is therefore defined as an intentional annihilation of a given group based on their shared identity. And so it's often based on nationality or ethnicity, but it also can be race or religious affiliation as well, as we know and we've seen in our world, unfortunately. And so the cultural genocide is an intentional destruction of a culture. However, it does not necessarily involve killing or violence against the members of that particular group that they're talking about. And due to the objections of various nations, in 1948, the UN Genocide Convention does not use the term cultural genocide, nor in the Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples within Canada. So
what is
there's,
it,
you know,
they considered ethnic?
Is
it ethnic?
Is what I call it.
No, is it called ethnic cleanse? Is that what the terminology is? Is what,
well, they don't
what,
use
what
that here either,
there?
No. You know, I haven't read that anyway.
I'm asking, is that what they're insinuating there?
That it would be like an ethnic cleansing?
Yeah, nowadays.
No, I've never heard it referred to as that. That's for sure. No, So going back, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which was established in 2008, because they're trying to have the schools investigated, because based on people who survived the schools, they're coming forward and telling their stories. And so it says that the final report documenting the experience is often tragic of at least 150,000 residential school students, and that's just in Canada. And they labeled the residential school system as a case of cultural genocide, but the final report defined cultural genocide as a destruction of those structures and practices that allow the group to continue as a group. So we're getting stuck on the semantic gymnastics of the word genocide, but they were these children, thousands of Indigenous children across the country, were forcibly removed from their birth homes, and in 1985, the Justice Edwin Kimlin's report on Indigenous people and child welfare policies, No Quiet Place, also argued that the cultural genocide had been taking place as a systematic, routine manner. So, you know, and then they go on to talk about other parts of this inquiry. And so they said they had come up with, and they've been doing this study for years, and in 2019, the inquiry finally released a 1,200-page document detailing its findings, including 231 recommendations. So they were trying to reconcile, the government was trying to reconcile themselves with the survivors of these schools and how that it systematically violated their human rights. And it's here that according to this inquiry, the primary reason for the higher rates of violence against Indigenous peoples in Canada is the persistent and deliberate human and Indigenous rights violations and abuses. And it all goes back to the kids in the schools. But, you know, you have this, anyway, I'm going to tell you a little story I went to lunch, I went to supper one time with one of the women that I worked with, and one of the things that we were taught in school when I was taking nursing, you had to recognize the different cultural differences between the people that came into the hospital to be cared for. And so they had different things. And one of the things we were taught was when First Nations people come into the hospital, they come into the hospital, but so does half the tribe. Like, they have a lot of people that come, if there's somebody sick, they come and they sit with them. And there's many of them, like, in a room and that sort of thing. And because they're indigenous, they have, I'm going to say, like, a card, a free card, that they can eat for free at the cafeteria.
Do they not have their own hospitals? I'm just curious.
I'm sure they're in the larger communities, probably a hospital on the reserve, maybe. I know they have clinics in all of the reserves, so, but as far as a hospital, not in New Brunswick, they don't. They may have in larger areas I'm not aware of. But so anyways, I digress. This girl I was sitting with was commenting because there was a group of First Nations people having their supper. And she made a very derogatory comment with regard to them. And I said, and then she said, we used to get this frequent flyer. And she described the girl to me. I knew immediately who it was because my family fostered her and her sister. And she was unmistakably described. You would know her if you know what I mean, but I won't give any identifying information. So she made a comment. She called her, I'm just going to use the initials, BFFI. And I said, well, what does that mean? Oh, you know, she was a big, fat, blank Indian. And I thought, wow. And I looked at her. Yeah, she said that out loud. And I said, did you know this person that you're speaking of? She said, well, I saw her all the time when she'd come into the hospital. I said, do you know what her background is? And she said, no. I said, well, I do. I said, she lived in my house. And I know what her background was. And, you know, I proceeded to tell her that I knew about this girl. And I said, you're really very rude and ignorant and prejudiced. She didn't bat an eye. She was proud of her observations. And I saw her prejudice in action with other First Nations on our floor when we had patients. And so you have this mentality out there who think that they're much better than First Nations, and they still treat them as if they're dirt under their feet. And before I say any more, hi, Deb. Welcome aboard. Deb's here in the room.
Hello.
Thank you for calling in. Just we're talking about the genocide, the cultural genocide and the physical genocide. They finally agreed that this was these residential schools, and what they did with the kids was a cultural genocide and a genocide as well of their very lives. And of course, this also came into see the women and the Indian Act, and they enacted all these acts, and which are modern day treaties, as far as I'm concerned. And they had, you know, this is a very dark part of history, and this was like from legislation that was in existence in Alberta and British Columbia from 1928 to 1972, and in British Columbia from 1933 to 1973, forced sterilization of Indigenous women in Canada.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Oh,
wow. That seems to be.
So, you know, and on. Yeah, and so there were all kinds of these horrific things taking place amongst these people that the country was not aware of, obviously. And then here's another little thing. Approximately 100 Indigenous women have alleged they've been pressured to consent to sterilization between 1970s and 2018, often while in vulnerable states of pregnancy or childbirth. 2018, kids. Like, seriously, wow. So there's a lot of horrible things that are going on that we're not aware of, and I don't know that people really, maybe this will open up their eyes, finding these graves with these tiny bones of little kids, you know, that, Deb, I don't know if you've been listening to the show or not, but I hope that you have, just so that you know you're catching up with what we're talking about. But I'm going to get Frank to read your piece, Frank, and then Deb will get you to do yours, and then I'll close it out after that. So I'm going to put
SoundCloud,
I believe.
I have a SoundCloud.
Okay, I'll push the button.
SoundCloud.
I remember that now. Okay, wait, now I'm going to put it in the room. I still got to put it in the room for everybody to read. Hang on a second. Okay, here we go. There. It's in the room, and I'll push the button right now. Here we go.
Thank you.
The ancestral winds of a path blow mightily with haunting echoes of a forgotten time, as the beats of the native drums resound over the marked graves of burials of sacrifices. A myriad of children lost in the pages of history, secrets of the dead not revealed nor exposed. The distant cries of the faces of the innocents. The stain of a remembrance of a country's disgrace. The dark veil of a scarlet mystery uncovered then. Forlorn hopes destroyed by the hands of oppression, a culture effaced and reduced to decades of anonymity, but the proud memories were never, ever forgotten. The dripping dew of the rain covers the wild roses, in the tears of yesterday and the sighs of today. The gentle currents of the river's fragile woes disguise the drowning laments of boys and girls. Exiled to the destiny of the imposed sins of martyrs, hidden in the mask of the silent voices of cleansing, whose names once deafened, alive in a brazen wake of spirits, by the imperious epitome of the makers of self-righteousness.
Wow. That was... And I want to say thank you so much for writing
in
the
poem.
Oh, you're welcome. I tried to write a piece there that had a Native American feel with the music and the write.
You
I mean, I know that perhaps I went a little bit too far there with the disgrace there of Canada. I didn't mean to say
no,
that.
No, not at all.
I was
it
trying to get a feel of, and in general, and I was trying to get something in general there because I wanted to apply this to all Native Americans' plight as well. But I threw in what I could get, the feeling and the information I got, and just the feel, you know, it was a feel that I got into that, you know, like, it just absorbed me there to write this piece, yeah.
I thought it was a beautiful piece, and you did justice to the topic and certainly to the souls of those who are in that ancestral wind. And I very much appreciate your writing this. It was very well done and quite moving. And I think that, I think these kinds of things, there's many people that are sending up these emotions and sending up our own spirits and our souls to join those that are lost. And I really feel very strongly about that. You did a really great job, and I appreciate it. What did you think, Deb? Oh, where's Deb? She's gone.
No, I'm
not. No, Hatter's gone. Hatter dropped.
I think he needed to eat.
Okay.
But yeah,
what did you think?
I think that this is absolutely brilliant, Frank. I just saved it, as a matter of fact. I just realized this isn't something that you just wrote. It's 7 years old, and yet it's brilliant, perfect for the prompt, like the myriad of children lost in the pages of history, or down further, the dark veil of a scarlet mystery uncovered, the tragic bits and pieces of history that we find out as we go are so gut-wrenching and disheartening sometimes, and something like this is just, I mean, how can you not think of the torment and the anguish and not want to cry? And there was something in the tone of your voice here, the deep, gripping power of your voice as you read, turned this one into one of my favorites of yours, really. I think that it's a brilliant voice through the ancestral wind.
Awesome. No, I appreciate that.
Really awesome.
Perhaps it was the music there, Deb. I guess it was that tone, you know, it set me in that tone there, that serious tone there of the music. It's a beautiful music, Native American, the flute there, it's a beautiful sound there. So I just let myself go with the sound of the flute.
Beautiful piece.
Sorry.
Beautiful piece. No, that's okay.
No, I just wanted to say thank you for having me to be able to do the piece there. I wish I could stay on longer, my friends, but I'm so dead tired tonight. I just want to say thank you once more, and it was a great piece there, a great theme there, Lady A. I thought you chose a great theme for tonight. I have to say I didn't know about the story here, but certainly you enlightened me with the right there, and I have to appreciate that.
I'm gonna plead with you to stay to hear Deb, and then
I will hear Deb.
I wanted to
go ahead.
Yeah. I just wanted to end the show with something else that's very brief but profoundly written, and I would very much like if you I know that it's Friday night. You can sleep in tomorrow.
I didn't get much sleep today, but I'll try. I'll definitely go ahead. If Deb is going to read, I'll stay for Deb. So, I mean, I have to stay for Deb.
So Deb, I'm going to put yours in the room so you can read yours too. Okay. And then I'm going to read something that was written, oh, you're going to put it in there already? Okay, good. That I feel would be very cathartic for all of us with regard to this topic. Okay, we got it in there, Deb. So when you're ready, we're ready.
Okay. And without trying to shape it, I formatted it a little bit odd because I wanted it to have a for lack of a better word, a totem pole feel. Anyway.
Okay.
It's called Whipping Winds Blow Cold. And that photo is actually outside of that place. it's all them little sneakers and boots, and yeah, that's there right there.
Oh, my God.
Okay, so we pray for the babies ripped from homes, torn from families, then locked in schools. With guards, without food. The babies that lay trembling in darkness as footsteps echo down the halls. Children are hit, kicked, touched, beaten to death. Buried on the school grounds in the holes that boys dig for the child standing at their side. For a friend, neighbor, sibling. Parents are told they ran off. The sunshine marks the dirt as rays cast 215 tombstone marks that hide the dark history. Breezes carry the little voices from the weeping ghosts of those children. Death whispers howl at midnight, screaming for daddy. Muffled whimpers calling, mommy. Calling anybody. But no people stepped up. Nobody. End poem.
Wow, Deb. This is really beautiful, and I love the honesty in it. I love that you didn't mince words in it either, you know, when you talked about what they experienced when they heard those footsteps coming down the halls. I really appreciate you writing to this. I can't even tell all of you, I can't even tell how much it means that you've taken time to write to this horrible finding. I think you, the last, the death whispers howl at midnight, screaming for daddy, muffled whimpers calling mummy, calling anybody, but nobody stepped up, nobody. And I could feel that. You could hear the voices, the sadness, the fear, the just outright fear, and I just thought you did a tremendous job with this. I very much appreciate it. What did you think?
Thank you, sir.
Yes, I thought it was very, very powerful here. You know, the whole notion there of what she encompasses in this film is a stark truth, you know. I don't know what happened completely there because I wasn't there, but Deb, you sure damn make it so credible, so believable. You make it seem, you know, that you bring us to these halls there. You bring us to the time period of this event here, of this tragedy here. And just, you bring the whole notion of human nature, the aspect of which, you know, we should all relate to when it comes to these type of themes. Never forget that, you know, underneath this all, they, you know, they were children. They were human beings who didn't deserve this, you know. And, it, you know, this is why they say the innocence of the youth is always to be preserved, because they lean on us, the adults, to guide them. So this is just a beautiful write. It's a very difficult write. It's very compelling. And the imagery throughout is it's beautiful, the way you brought in this I'm lost for words. I don't know what else to say, Deb. You really, you brought this anguish here and story here to such a remarkable degree of just the reality of what happened to these children here, you know. And although it's been years since this happened here, perhaps to many of us who are not from Canada, who know very little of it, you know, we still can relate as human beings. We were all children at one time. So this really brought these, you know, really incredible memories, you know, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, I don't know what else to say, except it's just, you left me speechless here.
Yeah, well, thank you.
I agree.
Thank you both.
You're welcome.
I want to read something briefly, and then we can probably close the show down early, because, but this was something that was written and came out a couple of days ago, and it's written by Abigail Echo Hawk, and it is an absolutely, I'll read it, and you'll see that it's much more comforting to know and to look at it from this area, this aspect. So here it goes. It begins saying, When they buried the children, what they didn't know, they were lovingly embraced by the land, held and cradled in a mother's heart. The trees wept for them with the wind. They sang mourning songs their mothers didn't know how to sing, bending branches to touch the earth around them. The Creator cried for them, the tears falling like rain. Mother Earth held them until they could be found. And now our voices sing the morning songs with the trees, the wind, light, sacred fire, ensure they are never forgotten as we sing justice. By Abigail Echo Hawk. Isn't that just absolutely beautiful?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Wow.
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 Absolutely beautiful.
When I saw that, I just thought, what an amazing tribute to the kids, and what a comforting thought to
and
think
an absolutely
that this
perfect way to wrap up this show. I can't. I mean, you couldn't have found a more perfect thing to do to close out a show than that. Wow. Wow.
Yeah. And I thank Abigail Echo Hawk for her wonderful words of comfort. And now those children they're free. They're freed from the bondage that they had for so many years. And I want to thank all of you. Like, I thank Hatter hung with me, and we talked and discussed and shared, and I really appreciate that, Hatter. And for you calling in, Deb, and for Frank, for you calling in, and Budo writing, Titus Llewellyn writing, and I really, really appreciate it. And it was a very serious discussion tonight, but I could not speak to it. And I thank you for the opportunity to take this forum to share the evening. And I would encourage all of us to look at our own First Nations people. We're on one planet and one earth and one people. One of the shows I've often thought that would inspire people is one with Diane Sawyer and a young Lakota boy. If you want to Google that and watch that video, it's absolutely amazing. And the plight of the young people goes on today. And so I thank you for participating and sharing the importance of tonight's program. I really appreciate it.
It was a powerful topic for sure. Mm. Did you play Titus's
yes,
SoundCloud?
Yeah, I did.
Awesome.
He had a beautiful poem too, and you know, and Frank, you know, you writing to the show as well, and being it being such a powerful piece, and Deb, yours, holy cow, like you guys really blew me away with your poetry and the power behind your words, and so I very much appreciate it. And I hope
it's always a pleasure.
Well, I appreciate you calling in, and I just hope that we can somehow learn to be better people. I don't know what it's going to take, if it will ever take place. It just we need to be better people and kinder to each other.
It takes by we have to be first conscious of that first there, Lady A, before we can strive.
Yeah.
We have to be aware of what we're striving for. Some of us are aware, and some of us continue in ignorance.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true, isn't it?
Indeed. All right,
amazing show. Tomorrow
thank
night, love
so
letters to Lady A and her ocean.
Yeah,
oh,
I put a piece there.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to get a song. a SoundCloud for that, Lady A. I'll definitely, if I have to squeeze some time, I'll see if I get. I know it's a written piece I wrote already, I believe, a year ago, but I thought it does fit well. And I'll see if I can get a SoundCloud for that as well.
All right. That'll be fun.
That's one I did. Yeah, tomorrow at 11 p.m. Eastern. And then I don't know what he's doing yet, but Sunday is Hatter Music.
Okay.
Also at 11.
Okay, we'll see you tomorrow night. Thanks, everybody. Truly, I'm so happy that I was able to do this show tonight. Thank you so much.
Great show. Love and respect.
Thanks.
Love and respect.
Thank you.
Always. Amor y respeto.
Night.
Thank you.
Buenas noches.